Hello, everybody, and welcome to Sports Talk Chicago's MLB special. My name is John Zagluel, owner and operator of the site. We have a lot to get to today, covering the MLB as a whole in this podcast, so of course talking about Cubs and Sox news, but then delving deeper into the MLB, talking about some major storylines, and later on, having a special guest from MLB Network. But first, just a few quick announcements. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at ChiTalkSports. Hit me up personally on Google+, Instagram, and LinkedIn at John Zags, and on Twitter at John Z Sports. Also, if you're looking for a place here in the local area to book parties, paint your own pottery, and have art classes for both adults and children, check out the Arts and Crafts Studio by Mucci World, where inspiration meets creation. You can find them at the Tinley Park Down Shopping Center at 7913 West 171st Street in Tinley Park, Illinois. If you have any questions, give them a call at 708-247-2100. Again, that's 708-247-2100. You know, something that I find very fascinating about Major League Baseball is the fact that it's so unpredictable. Case in point, when looking at some stats and some league leaders this year, something that really stands out to me in the batting average category are the top five guys for batting average itself. I mean, who would have thought at the beginning of this season that Odubel Herrera, Mookie Betts, Nick Markakis, Andrelton Simmons, and Manny Machado would be top five in all of baseball in batting averages? And all of those guys also are sporting OPSs above 900. But if you look further down on that list, I'm going to number 10 right now, you'll see a familiar name, at least for those who are Cubs fans here, listening to the show. Jorge Soler currently has a .331 batting average and is 10th in all of baseball through 127 at-bats. Now, of course, at first when I saw this, I had to rub my eyes a little bit and realize that this was Jorge Soler here from the Cubs when he had come up and really made an impact through his first 24 games. I remember that year he hit .292 in that small sample size, but there were many people considering him to be the next big thing for the Cubs. I mean, personally myself, I was 14 years old at the time. I wrote an article comparing him and his rapid success to Yasiel Puig, because at the time, of course, Puig mania had hit the MLB. So I was so infatuated with Soler, then he ended up really not panning out here in Chicago. The year after, .262, and the last year here in a Cubs uniform, hit .238, was actually atrocious, and of course, you know me, I said right away that he would be a bust, but now seeing him this year with Kansas City, after now it being his fifth year in baseball, it seems like he's starting to figure it out. And I have to say, though, I'm a little disappointed in him, because why couldn't he have figured it out here in Chicago? That makes no sense to me, because he could have really helped this team play in the outfield in right or left and alleviate some of the pressure that the team currently has with guys like Kyle Schwarber, Ben Zobrist, and even Chris Bryant getting innings due to the injury of Jason Hayward. But nevertheless, we'll talk about that later on in the Cubs news segment. But still, why has Jorge Soler become now a household name in Major League Baseball? There must be a statistical trend or a reason in which why his statistics and specifically his batting average and slash line have become much better. Well, looking at this season, in only 36 games, he has registered 22 walks. His career high for walks prior to this season were 32 over 366 at-bats. So, Soler before, as we all remembered, quite a free swinger. A guy who would not be as patient, somebody similar to a Javier Baez when he first came up. But now Baez this year also making some adjustments. So come this year for Soler, something must have clicked in his mind where he was like, you know what, I should stop being a free swinger, I need to get rid of that tendency or that flaw in my game, and sure enough, it's paid dividends for him, because now this is a guy top 10 in all of baseball in batting average with a slash line that goes as follows: 331, 431, 543, an OPS of 975. So I just wanted to mention that because seeing Jorge Soler produce at this level is something that I would have never imagined him doing, considering his performance here in Chicago and with the Cubs. Now it looks as if, now that Wade Davis is gone, maybe Kansas City won that trade after all. Something to think about. And while we're on the topic of surprises, could somebody explain to me why nobody is talking about Chris Davis hitting 11 home runs so far for the A's in 39 games? Could someone also tell me why over the past 3 years he's hit a total of 96 home runs and yet nobody is willing to give him the time of day? I mean, my goodness, this guy is coming off of back-to-back 40 home run seasons and is starting off even hotter by hitting 11, and yet nobody knows who he is, nor talks about him. Now, I know he's on the A's, a smaller market team, but Chris Davis needs to get some more national media attention because he has been doing very well now for a sustained period of time. Now, some may argue that, okay, you know, despite those home run totals, he may have some problems with his average or on-base percentage, but what I contend is this. Davis is not meant to be that type of guy. In fact, he's a three true outcome guy. Now, what does that mean for some people at home? He either homers, strikes out, or walks most of his at-bats, similar to an Adam Dunn, or in today's game, to Aaron Judge or Miguel Sano. Did you hear what I just said? Chris Davis is actually comparable to Aaron Judge, yet I can guarantee you that everyone listening right now knows who Aaron Judge is, yet has no idea who Chris Davis is. And this just isn't a message for listeners. I'm talking about for the MLB as a whole, because why has this guy not made an All-Star team either? He has finished as one of the top home run hitters in all of baseball the past 2 years and has gotten no love from the fans in regards to the All-Star game ballot, nor even his peers in regards to making it as a reserve. So, I implore you all to pay more attention to Chris Davis as we go by during this season and also give him some love because this is a guy, again, who can hit 40 home runs per season, yet for some reason, one or another, nobody knows about him. And that's a problem because he is putting up superstar-type numbers, thereby deserving more attention on the national level. And before we start talking about the Cubs or Sox, I'd also like to touch on Shohei Ohtani and the way in which he has really taken this game by storm by providing some antics both as a hitter and as a pitcher, something that we have not seen since the era of Babe Ruth. Now, I will say, prior to the beginning of the season, during spring training, I was a bit skeptical about Ohtani and his potential. I mean, sure, he did it in Japan. He did win 42 games on the mound while hitting just over .285, but still, I had my doubts because the Japanese league and the MLB are completely different. Pitching is much easier to hit, and as evidenced by Yu Darvish's problems right now, Japanese pitchers here in America don't necessarily last long nor stay effective for a longer period of time. So I was obviously worried, and his spring training did not go well. Ohtani hit under 200 at the plate, and on the mound had an ERA over 5. But once the season began, he must have turned something on, flipped some sort of switch, because he has come out just rolling, hitting .348 at the plate with 5 home runs. That's only in 69 at-bats, and on the mound, registering an ERA just over 4, which is okay, but continuing to throw 100 miles per hour at some points, and also stymieing hitters, as evidenced by his 10.9 strikeouts per 9 innings. So Ohtani right now is the real deal. And later on in the show when we talk to our special guest, I'm going to ask him about Ohtani and what he thinks about his potential to sustain this progress and sustain this success for himself. Because as we know, as the season goes on, it's going to take wear and tear on his body, especially being a dual threat. Also, you've got scouting reports compiled over the year, and eventually they're going to figure out Ohtani both at the plate and on the mound. So there are some problems and some roadblocks that Ohtani could face later on. But up until this point, I'm just going to enjoy the show, because it's been over 100 years since we've seen someone like this, that being Babe Ruth. So right now, it is captivating everybody watching Major League Baseball, including myself, and I'm just happy to be able to witness history like I have via Shohei Ohtani. Now, moving on to some Cubs news, and there have been some big headlines coming out today regarding Jason Hayward. Now, you may remember that Hayward, about a week and a half ago, suffered a concussion after crashing into the wall on an attempted home run catch against the Cardinals. Now, today, he was scheduled to come off the 7-day DL for concussions, yet Joe Maddon sparked some headlines by saying that Hayward is not ready to come off the DL, and to make it even worse, there is no timetable for his return. Now, of course, his bet will not be missed, hitting .227, but his defense sure will. Case in point, we look at yesterday's game as the Cubs and White Sox took on each other. Chris Bryant was in the outfield in right, taking Hayward's position. There was a fly ball hit to him, and it just hopped off his glove and went all the way to the ivy. Runs scored, and it hurt C.J. Edwards and almost cost the Cubs the game as it got close later on. Now, the Hayward dilemma is cause for concern, and the reason I'm talking about it is because why is Chris Bryant playing right field anymore? Let's be honest now, Bryant is not an outfielder, and although he came up back in 2015 playing some games in left and right, now he's an established superstar and a former MVP. There should be no reason why Bryant has to go out there and play while giving someone like David Bodie an opportunity at third base. Then again, though, if you're Joe Maddon, you've got to be scratching your head, because after Bryant, the only viable options for those corner positions are Kyle Schwarber, Ben Zobrist, and the recently called up Mark Zagunas. I'm obviously assuming that Albert Almora will continue to play center. So with that four-guy mix playing two spots, that's cause for concern. And all of those names, with the exception of Zagunas because he is a true outfielder, they sound quite murky at best, because none of those guys can play the position well defensively. We all know about Kyle Schwarber's woes in the outfield, and we've seen them on display even this year. Ben Zobrist is not a natural outfielder either, and he doesn't look graceful or even confident when playing out there. And then obviously Bryant, I feel, is out of favor now, especially after that error late in the game against the Sox. But with all of that being said, I still would say this, that if you're going to make an addition or subtraction of that outfield mix while Jason Hayward is banged up and on the disabled list, get rid of Chris Bryant. Keep the rotation of Schwarber, Zagunas, and Zobrist, because at least in that case, you can start Zagunas in right, a natural outfielder, and not have to worry about the liabilities that both Zobrist and Schwarber bring. Either way, as much as it pains me to say this, I hope Jason Hayward comes back soon. Although I continuously criticize his performance at the plate, his defense, especially in this case, is much needed considering the other options available for the Cubs. And for future reference as well, the Cubs need to seriously consider investing in a true outfielder. Somebody who will be on the free agent market next year, instead of trying to convert players who are normally infielders or catchers, hint hint to Kyle Schwarber there, into outfielders. Because that process does not work. You need somebody who can actually play the outfield, who can range over and cover certain areas, and be ready when the time matters. Because right now, the Cubs defensively are not looking good, and that's going to hurt them as the season continues. Now moving on to some Chicago White Sox news and some big headlines coming from the South Side. The White Sox are historically bad right now. And how bad, you ask? Well, they've opened the season 9-27, which is the team's worst start to open the year in the franchise's 118-year history, topping 1948's 10-26 opening. But I'm not going to sit here and bash the entire White Sox team, because ironically enough, it's not the whole team that's causing all of these losses. Because offensively right now, there's some key players who are performing quite well, I might add. I mean, Matt Davidson has 11 home runs. He's one of the league leaders. Wellington Castillo has 5 homers, and Jose Abreu's hitting .285. So it's not necessarily the offense, but someone that I do want to point my finger at is the pitching staff, and not just the starters, the bullpen as well. So, obviously, and we talked about this in the last show, Reynaldo Lopez is the only good pitcher right now for the White Sox. His 2.44 ERA is actually placing as one of the best ERAs in the American League, but around him, no one is doing well. James Shields, an ERA near 6. Giolito, an ERA over 7, and Carson Fulmer now, an ERA over 6. But looking at the bullpen as well, nobody that I can see has an ERA under 4.0, which means that, number one, mistakes are being made. Lots of runs are being given up, meaning that blown holds and blown saves are something of normalcy at this point. And also, the team lacks a definite closer. I mean, although Joaquin Soria has somewhat assumed the job, he's blown 2 saves already and has an ERA near 4.5. Yet the problem with that is that no one behind him is doing any better. So it's hard for the team to decipher who is the best arm to assume that closer's role. Because we mentioned a long time ago, this was back in spring training, that the battle was between Joaquin Soria and Nate Jones for the job. Well, Jones this year has an ERA near 4.5, and Soria not much better. So at that point, it's like, well, who are you supposed to choose? And there's the problem, the fact that there's not a right answer. So if you're a Sox fan, or if you're anyone following baseball and wondering why the Sox are doing so horribly, don't point your fingers at the offense, because when you take a look at some statistics, you'd be surprised at how many guys are somewhat succeeding, especially via the long ball. You should be pointing your finger at, however, the bullpen and the starting rotation. Because when you have one pitcher with an ERA under 3.0, that's a recipe for disaster. And right now, the White Sox are living in that horrific fantasy, a time in which they have no starting nor relief pitcher to provide any sort of quality innings. And with that, it's time for our special guest. He played in the MLB for 11 years, being a part of the Oakland A's and their Moneyball era in the early 2000s, while placing 11th in the NL MVP vote in 2007. During his playing days, he also got into broadcasting, contributing to ESPN's Baseball Tonight while hosting his own show on Fox Sports Arizona. Today, he is a part of MLB Network, appearing on shows such as MLB Tonight and MLB Central. Please welcome Eric Burns to the show. Eric, how are you doing today, and thank you for being here on the show.
John, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
So, first off, I'd like to talk about some storylines going on right now in the MLB, and specifically Shohei Ohtani, because right now, I mean, he's doing things that haven't been done in over 100 years since the Babe Ruth era. So, what are your thoughts and impressions of him so far, and how much has he made an impact on this Angels team?
Well, I think I was skeptic, like a lot of other people going into this, just because we haven't seen it done at such a high level. I think there's guys who have played in the past, and you know, even in my generation, that had the ability to do it. But there's one thing having the ability to pitch and hit both, but then there's a whole other thing when you do it at just this ridiculously high level. So, my biggest questions on Ohtani coming into this season were the fact that he's never had more than like 350 plate appearances in Japan. Now, when it came to his pitching, I wasn't worried about his pitching. That dude throws 100 miles per hour. I mean, you can throw 100 miles per hour, and so long as you throw strikes, you're going to get guys out. But when it comes to hitting big league pitching consistently, you need repetitions. It's the same reason why no matter who you are, we see you go through the minor league system, and there's been very few guys, very few, in the history of baseball have ever just, boom, right up in the big leagues after, you know, maybe a season in the minors and then, you know, go on to have these storied Hall of Fame type careers. I just want to be just pump the brakes a little bit in knowing that let's see once the league goes through them second, third time around, because this is a league that will constantly make adjustments to you. And, all that said, we need to celebrate him because he's good for the game. He is the number one story. He's the number one most talked about player in baseball right now, and for good reason. I want nothing but for success for this dude. This guy makes my job more interesting. This guy makes baseball more interesting, and I'm rooting for him along the way. I'm just trying to, I don't know, maybe give people an idea of what to expect, because, again, we've seen this time and time again where guys come up, blaze of glory, And then it's a little bit of an adjustment period.
Right, and you talked about the league making adjustments, and that is a perfect segue into my next question, because I wanted to know, like, do you think that he can maintain this type of production all year? Because what he's doing right now is simply incredible, but, you know, come September, October, come playoffs possibly for the Angels, and come that end of the year, how could we see Ohtani defer or be the same compared to what he's doing now?
So long as he stays healthy, yes, on the mound. I don't think what he's doing with the bat is sustainable. And there's been certain at bats that I've watched of his that make me believe, oh, you know what, maybe it is. And I say this because, you know, I still feel like there's this hole inside on his swing. And but you have to understand, John, like there's a hole inside on everybody's swing. So if a pitcher is able to consistently put the ball in under his hands, he's going to have a tough time getting to it. But I think ultimately, you know, it's a matter of not either doing two things. Number one, laying off that pitch, or number two, just wasting the pitch. And I saw one at bat, it was about a week ago, where it was the guy was trying to pound him in. It was foul ball, foul ball, foul ball, foul ball. And he's just wasting all these pitches. And then guess what? Then he gets the ball out over the plate and drills it up the middle for a base hit. That's all you have to do. You don't have to hit that pitch. You don't need to cover every inch of the plate. You just need to be able to survive long enough to go ahead and get your pitch, and then that's the pitch you're going to do damage on. Joey Votto does it better than anybody in all of baseball, and it's not even close. Where if it's not his pitch, he will waste it. He will waste it. He will waste it. I think the two most underrated things when it comes to a hitter, and when you talk about how great of a hitter he is number one, is wasting pitches. And then the other thing is check swinging. We don't talk about check swings enough. The guys who have the ability to check swing, right, because it's go, 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 and you got to be able to make yourself stop. Well, the great ones make themselves stop just about every single time, where the mediocre ones, they're not able to. You see a lot of check swings. You see them go through the zone, and it ends up being a strike, and it ends up costing them an at-bat.
So I wanted to shift gears now to baseball here in Chicago, talking about the Cubs. They are going through some troubles. I mean, they have reached the 20-win mark, but they are still bunched up with three other teams for the division lead. So what are your thoughts on the Cubs, and do you see them eventually running away with this NL Central division like they have in years past?
No, absolutely not. The Cubs are still the Cubs. I think they're good. They're a good team. I think they're one of the better teams in the National League. They're right up there. You know, them, the Nationals, the Diamondbacks. Diamondbacks are coming off a tough series against the Nationals. But the Brewers are going to be more competitive. St. Louis looks like they're for real. They're the same old. They're up to the same old tricks. You know, they're always finding a way to be competitive. The Cubs, though, I almost want to put them. And this is probably not fair to the Golden State Warriors, but I also want to kind of put them in the Warriors category, where it's like, you know, they know they're not necessarily playing, you know, just to get to the postseason. They're playing to win a championship. And the way Steve Kerr is, you know, let's say coached his team through the course of the season has been to do everything he can to set them up to win a championship. So, and look, 162 games. You know, so I couldn't say there's this dire urgency, but, you know, just thinking about what they did last year and the, you know, the big run they went on, I think it was after the All-Star break. Like, that's, look, you know, at some point this season, this with the pitching staff and, you know, the lineup, they're just incredibly talented. I think this team's going to take off. But is it going to, does that mean that, you know, they're going to run? No, they're not going to run away with it because of the competition, I think, in the Central is better. Who would have thought the Pirates would be playing the type of baseball, you know, that they are? And so that just takes, you know, you're playing them, what is it, 18, 19 times, and all of a sudden, you know, what was easy wins right there, all of a sudden those wins aren't going to come by, you know, as easy. So I just think there's more competition, and I do see them probably ending up on top. They're going to have to work for it a little bit more.
Now, as for the White Sox, it is evident that they are going through numerous problems, but then again, obviously, they're in the middle of a rebuild. So what have you seen from some of these younger players so far, and do you see a vision of success for the Sox in the future?
Yeah, I like him. But Davidson's really kind of caught my eye. I like the way he goes about his business. You look at the White Sox, and it's just, what was it, Giolito yesterday, where he walked seven and threw a bunch of wild pitches, and that but he went 5 2/3 or something and gave up two hits. Like, it just, they're kind of all over the place. I mean, that's kind of who the Sox are, this season. But they're young, they're talented, they're all over the place. Even Davidson's been awfully streaky, unless he's obviously hitting in Kauffman Stadium. But they're an interesting group to watch going forward. I think, at least if you're not going to be good, if you're not going to be a team that's going to be competing for a playoff spot, you want to be interesting, right? You want to give fans something to, a reason to come to the ballpark. And this team definitely will give you that.
So being part of a rebuild for a minute, I wanted to touch on that, because when you played, you were part of teams who weren't necessarily successful, the Rockies, the Orioles, and then the Diamondbacks in 2006. So what was the atmosphere like during times like that, where, the team that you were on knew that they weren't necessarily making the postseason, similar, obviously, to the White Sox today? How were you guys able to get through that? And you personally, how were you able to perform, knowing that in the end, you guys still weren't going to make the playoffs? What was that like?
Well, what's crazy is that I came up with the A's. So from 2000 to 2005, before I got traded, we were in contention every day. We knew we were in contention for the playoffs. I think we ended up going to the playoffs with 4 out of 5 years then. And then I got traded to the Rockies, and I was there for 2 weeks. So it was like I didn't even unpack my suitcase before I was shipped off to Baltimore. It wasn't like this, really long sort of drawn out experience there where I could say that, I got a great pulse of how the guys went about their business. But I'll say this, and this probably relates to the White Sox and the situation they're in right now, because that was a Rockies team. That was 2005. I was with them, and Clint Hurdle was the manager of that team, and it's just everything about that team just reeked to positivity. And it started with the manager, but it's just the guys that they had in the clubhouse, whether it's Matt Holliday or Garrett Atkins, obviously Todd Helton. It was just Corey Sullivan was there. Ryan Spielberg got called up. It's just these guys were positive. Jeff Francis. I don't know. There's something about it where it's like, this team's going to be good. But there was nothing record wise that said that we were going to be good, right? But I'm like, this team's going places. Like, they got some serious talent. It's just Aaron Cook was another guy, the sinker baller. So you have the right pieces in place. And sure enough, 2 years later, they ended up in the World Series in 2007. So I think it's just, look, you stay the course, you win the day. That's all you can do. You break baseball's so long that the only thing you can do is you break it down to, it's not even winning the day. I mean, it's about winning the individual battle, the at bats, the play, the plays out in the field. It's literally one of those games. You got to focus so much on the process and not worry about the end result. And that's typically when you start seeing results.
I wanted to throw it back to 2003 for a minute. You mentioned your time with the A's, and you hit for the cycle in a game against San Francisco. So what was that like for you? And take me through that last at-bat. I know you hit a ball into center field. The center fielder misplayed it and went all the way to the wall. So you were hustling around second base, heading for third. What was that experience like for you, getting that triple and then clinching the cycle?
That was pretty cool. It was sort of a weird day. It started off with a check swing, single up the middle. And then I think my next two at-bats, maybe it was like a double. I think I did a double, and then I hit a homer out to center field. And the thing was is that I grew up a San Francisco Giants fan, so we were playing in AT&T Park at San Francisco. It was Pac Bell Park at the time. And I was playing for the A's. Well, typically in the Bay Area, you're either an A's fan or a Giants fan. So all my boys that I grew up were all Giants fans. And one of them called me on the way up, and they were just talking trash, and they said they were going to the game today. And they were sitting in center field, front row bleacher seats. And so I said, all right, man. I said, make sure you catch that ball I hit out to you. And so then it was my third at bat when I came up, and I literally hit a home run right over their heads.
Oh, my goodness.
So kind of got a big chuckle out of that. And I'm just, you know, at that point, it's just like, man, what an incredible day. We were winning. I had three knocks, whatever. And the cycle, obviously, when you have a single, double, and trip, single, double, and homer, it's going to come to your mind. You know, especially in that park, just since they have Triples Alley. So I ended up, keeping it in the back of my mind. And the next at bat, I drilled the ball off the left field wall, which had I had a little bit of thought of trying to stretch it into a triple, but there's just no way I could have. And then the last at bat was facing Felix Rodriguez. This goes back to what I was talking about, just focusing on the process. And Felix Rodriguez at the time was throwing, 98 miles per hour. He had a nasty slider, and I'm like, man, again, last thing on my mind is triple at this point, and I had to just lock into this battle with him. He throws a two-strike slider down and away. I poke it out to center field for a base hit. And as the center fielder's running in, Carlos Valderrama was his name, and he comes running in because he was trying to figure out if he's going to try to dive for it or not, and he tries to pull up, and as he pulls up, he slips, and then the ball goes over his head, and then at that point, I was hustling around first, and second, third, and next thing you know, I was on third with a stand-up triple, and it was pretty cool just to have my family and friends there, and the fans actually gave me a very nice ovation. And amazingly, to this day, it's still been the only cycle that's ever been hit at AT&T Park, and it's something I can't really understand because of the Triples Alley and because there's so many triples there, and typically that's the hardest one to get, but it was definitely a pretty sweet experience.
Oh, wow. I didn't even know that stat about AT&T Park. That's impressive right there, especially when you talked about Triples Alley being there, and you're the only one still to this day to hit a cycle there. That's awesome.
Yeah, thank you. I don't know how much if impressive is the right word. I think it's more like an oddity. I think that, wow, I just have every year I've been like, hey, and I look, I'm not one of those guys that, if I had any sort of record or anything else, I never wanted anyone to know. It's, hey, I hope someone goes out there and gets to experience what I got to experience there on that day. It was the same thing that I went through with, the Cleveland Indians and them chasing down our 20-game win streak last year. Is that, I was rooting for those guys because I know how special and important that was, with the group of guys that we had on that 0-2 A's team.
So I wanted to also talk about your new book coming out titled The Fit List, Life Lessons from a Human Crash Test Dummy. Now, that alone sparks intrigue for me. So I'd love to hear why you decided to write the book and what it's all about.
Well, basically, when I got done playing, 2010 was my last year. I immediately started working for MLB Network, and I was taking these long flights back and forth between San Francisco and New York, and really was going through a transitional time in my life. Obviously, I wasn't playing baseball for the first time in 25 years. My father had just unexpectedly passed away, and I was going through this transitional period, really kind of trying to find, what to do next. And it was, first it was slow pitch softball and a lot of golf and a lot of surfing. And, eventually I actually ended up, transitioning to ultra endurance sports. So I got into doing Ironman triathlons and, then ultra marathons and then, that's kind of led to some other crazy adventures. But, really, I think what I learned kind of through all this is, number one, when I'm able to just kind of step back and take this objective view of my career and, my experiences as a child and then, going through high school and college and, getting drafted three different times and then getting called up to the big leagues and then sent up and down nine different times and then traded twice and released twice and just going through it, to be able to step back and look at that and then draw the life experiences from that. And then this, even more so, I think with, post career baseball and dealing with, some of the tragic events that I dealt with, in my life. And I mentioned my father, that was obviously pretty hard, but when I was 11, my best friend was killed, and it was just, you know, obviously something that was just, whoa. And I think the one kind of, you know, I'd say lesson, and there's 129 of them, ironically, but the one thing that I've learned in all of this, you know, and this includes the 100-mile race that I did and, you know, all these other crazy ultra-endurance stuff, is just one foot in front of the other. You got to be able to break it down to the process and enjoying the process and loving the process. And there's this famous term in Stoic philosophy called amor fati, and it's love your fate, love everything that happens to you, because we can't control so much of what happens to us, but we can control the way we react to it. So I really thought I could help. You know, I originally wrote all of this in sort of diary form, and I just felt like I could really, if I shared these experiences, it'll really help, you know, whether it's a kid or, you know, anyone going through a transitional part in their life, just help them charge on and help them keep moving forward and, you know, look back at, say, my experience and say, well, hey, look, this is what I did at that point. And, you know, I think the beautiful thing is that, you know, I'm still learning. And I'm still experiencing, and I think the biggest thing with that is continuing to learn from those experiences. So it's an easy read. You know, it's 497 pages, but they're short chapters. They'll start off with a quote from what I would consider a world influencer. You know, someone that I typically have a lot of respect for. And a lot of knowledge about, and then I back it up with, at the end of every chapter, is the human crash test dummy life lesson. It's gone really well so far, and we just released it the other day, at least the ebook version as well as the audiobook, and then the hard copies are all going out. They're all going out this week for all the pre-orders, but it's been fantastic, the reaction that we've gotten so far.
That's great. And, you know, all those experiences you mentioned, I mean, that is just unbelievable, really. Everything that you have gone through and overcome to write this book. And, you know, I wanted to ask you, how much did your dad mean to you? Because I know you mentioned such a tragic and sudden event. What was that like growing up with him? You know, did he help you, mentor you in regards to playing the game? And then when it happened, what was your reaction to that?
Oh, there's a lot. I mean, look, I grew up and my dad had never played baseball in his life. He was a musician. He played the saxophone, and you know, he played basketball in high school, and then, you know, he actually was a 4th-degree black belt in Kenpo karate, and he got really heavy into martial arts. And, you know, I think the greatest thing that my parents ever did for me is just let me find my own path, because I grew up, of course, doing martial arts and loved it and was traveling all over the country. You know, going to different karate tournaments, and I had trophies stacking up that were taller than I was, but I just fell in love with the team sports. And, you know, my mom was an avid tennis player, so it was like tennis was like super big in my life in the early going. And then eventually, there's something about, you know, the way I was wired, where when I did something for somebody else, when I did something for greater good than I think just myself, I was always better at it. And it, not only was I better at it, but I enjoyed it more. And, you know, it wasn't just, you know, about, you know, fulfilling whatever my selfish needs were. And not to say, look, that every, you know, karate or tennis player or individual sport person is selfish, but it's just, I really enjoyed the camaraderie. So I got into football and basketball and baseball. But guess what? My parents were so incredibly supportive the entire way. And then, of course, when I got done playing baseball is when I transitioned into doing the Ironman triathlons, and where everyone else in my life just thought I was absolutely nuts. And they're like, what are you doing? Like, why are you doing this? Why would you want to do this? You've been working hard for all these years. Well, it was my dad who was the one that was saying, yeah, this is awesome, man. And, you know, he actually wanted to join me. He's like, you know, what's this with the training process and this and that? And so I kind of was walking through him, you know, this and that. And then it was just, you know, it hit me like a ton of bricks, but I think it also, what it allowed me to do was, when I went on the long training rides and long training runs and everything else, it was very therapeutic, I think, for me to kind of have long conversations with my dad out there and just kind of reflect on life and whatnot. And I think that's what endurance sports has continued to allow me to do, is just kind of spend some time out there with, we call it solitary suffering. But it's really, I think, important. I mean, as a kid who grew up full-blown ADHD, just, you know, physical activity and what it does to the brain and stimulating the brain and whatnot is, it's so incredibly beneficial.
Well, that's an awesome story on your dad, and that's really cool, too. You know, you mentioned those triathlons. I know on your Instagram you recently posted something saying that you're going to be doing a triathlon across America. So I'd love to hear more about that and what inspired that idea as well.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. So, you know, it's funny because I've had a lot of reaction, you know, since I've told people about this, and this has been in the works for a while now. And I think it's first started when I wrote the book and we were thinking about a way to do some sort of book tour. And, you know, really it's tough because work with my time and commitments to work at MLB Network, it's like, you know, where could we really find the time to just, you know, travel all over the country? And that's really what you want to do with the book. It's just, and I just say that because you want to hit these towns that, that you otherwise, you know, wouldn't be able to. And again, when you have a message, at least I feel like I have a message, you know, that I'd love to get out there. I mean, that's the first thing you want to do. But, you know, the biggest thing is that, and this is, and I'm going to bring this back to kind of what I was just talking about with exercise and the mental and physical benefits. But basically, 97% of physical education in our country in public schools, everyday PE, has been taken out. 65% of kids participate in zero youth activity programs. Like,
wow.
It's so baffling to me. And then I think about myself as a kid, and, you know, again, like, I was full-blown ADHD, and I'm getting kicked out of class every single day. And, eventually, what happened is I realized the benefits of exercise and what it meant. And so when I went to junior high school, we ran into a PE coach that was just an absolute hard ass. And every single day it was like, we'd start with a mile around the track. And then after that, it was like, you know, we're immediately either we're playing softball, we're playing soccer, we're playing volleyball, we're playing, we're playing indoor hockey, whatever it is. And then I just noticed that, like, man, like, my grades went through the roof. And it was because of this everyday PE that was constant, it was moving. And the other thing was we started switching classes for the first time. So that was also extremely beneficial. But, you know, I think through going through all of that, going through that experiences, you know, those experiences, like, I would have never been able to succeed in the classroom. Or even I think in life ultimately without somebody giving me the opportunity to make this transition and have these opportunities. So when I see these numbers, I'm like, this is disgusting. It's a travesty that we're preventing kids who could have all this potential by sticking them in classrooms, by not allowing them to participate in after school youth activity programs, by, you know, not giving them an opportunity to go out and run and stimulate their brains each and every single day. There's literally charts that will show you how, especially with ADHD kids, but it doesn't matter. It's with all kids, and which will fire up the frontal lobe. So long story longer here, John, that basically what my wife and I did before we even decided to embark on this journey is we're like, hey, look, we want to create the Let Them Play Foundation. And the Let Them Play Foundation is 100% committed to getting youth and more active. It's as simple as that. Now, what we're going to do is we travel across the country. So I'm going to swim from San Francisco to Oakland, 7 miles, bike from Oakland to Chicago is 2,344 miles, and then run from Chicago to New York. But we're going to stop in different towns and cities along the way, and minor league ballparks, major league ballparks, whatever, whoever will have us. And we're going to do little fundraisers for, you know, the Let Them Play Foundation, along with you know, doing the book tour. But the funny thing is the book tour has kind of become secondary where, yeah, you know, I'll be there talking about the book and signing books and whatnot. But our main mission is to try to, you know, get some companies and maybe other individuals involved, to bring awareness to, the dwindling youth activity and do everything in our power. We're going to issue grants to the local organization. So that was the reason why we wanted to start our own, is like, hey, look, let's go ahead. For example, here in the Bay Area, we have an organization called Fit Kids, where it's all they do is promote, you know, youth activity and specifically in underserved communities. So we're going to, you know, we would take whatever money we raise as we're going through, say we go through Chicago and, you know, whatever the number is, you know, go in there and boom, here's a check to the Boys and Girls Club. Just anyone committed. And so we're going to have organizations be able to apply for grants and stuff. And this whole movement thing has become, I think, a lot bigger than any sort of book tour or any sort of triathlon. But again, and then the whole reason, well, why would you swim, bike, and run? Look, put your money where your mouth is. That's it. It's as simple as that. Don't tell me how to do something and not do it yourself. I've always been big on, you know, in responsive to someone who's going to show me as opposed to tell me. So this is my way of showing kids, like, hey, look, I'm making this journey across the country and this is how I'm doing it. And this is, you know, this is the benefits of it and whatnot. And then the other thing is I'd love to try to recruit people along the way with me and to do part of the swim with me, part of the run, part of the bike, whatever. And then hopefully just kind of make some noise and ultimately still, like I said, just bring awareness to kids and their lack of activity here.
Well, that's a great cause and making a statement by it as well. That's awesome. And I wish you all the best in that as well.
Thanks, John. I really appreciate that.
So on a final note, I wanted to ask you about one of your fantastic entrances on MLB Central. Now, it was Cinco de Mayo, and you army crawled across the floor before popping out with a wrestling mask on and scaring host Lauren Shahadi. So I wanted to ask, how did this come all about, and was this your idea, too? Because it was hilarious. I watched it live, and I loved it.
Yeah, we've come up with all sorts of things. I don't know. Some of them are mine. Amelia Schimmel was the producer that she's moved on. She's actually with the Oakland A's now. She runs their entire production department. But basically for the past like 3 years, four, yeah, I guess it was 3 years now, the two of us would come up and try to think of the most obscure, crazy, wild entrances we could. I think eventually the powers to be, the suits at MLB Network, got a little tired of them, and so we kind of scaled it back last season a little bit. I ended up putting on a horse head and then tried to replicate the crawl out and came up over the back of Robert Flores for my only appearance on Central this season. But just something to keep it light. I mean, look, the great thing about MLB Network is that the best thing, and it's not even close, is a team that they've assembled. Like there is not a bad dude or person in that network to work with. Everyone's a joy, and we're kind of like our own team. And it's what's cool is that it, you know, it keeps it light, and I don't think anyone takes themselves too seriously. Where, you know, I think in the TV world that you typically do run across people that take themselves too seriously, but I think ultimately we like to have fun. We like to analyze the game. We all love baseball, and it's just it's a pretty special place to work.
Well, Eric, thank you so much for being here on the show. Had a great time. Really happy to have you.
Yeah, thanks, John. Appreciate it, man.
Well, there you have it. Eric Burns here on today's show. Very fun time talking about his new book, talking about his time training for many triathlons that he's done, about his MLB career, and about his time on MLB Network. Well, that does it for us here at Sports Talk Chicago. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at Chi Talk Sports and hit me up personally on Google+, LinkedIn, and Instagram at John Zags and on Twitter at John Z Sports. Finally, make sure to subscribe to the website. You can find the box on the homepage where you can type in your email. By doing this, you will receive updates via email whenever we post a new podcast or article. You will be the first to know when new content is posted, therefore I highly suggest you check it out. Thank you all for listening to today's show, and have a great day.